We're very happy to have Harlow here, and Daniel's going to tell us about gauging space-time inversion. And so
Yeah.
whenever you're ready to share your slides.
All right, you see that?
Yeah.
Okay. So thanks for the invitation. Nice to be back virtually. I apologize for dragging you all back into the Zoom era. I couldn't get permission to go to Perimeter again, that's having just been there for 2 weeks over the summer. Yeah, I'm going to talk about a paper that I just put out with Tokiro Numasawa. I guess, oh, hey, Davide, like maybe a month ago, about gauging space-time inversions. I'm going to begin with an apparent tension between two plausible statements or conjectures about assumptions about quantum gravity. Just as a notational aside, okay, so people usually talk about CPT symmetry. I'm going to speak of CRT symmetry, where R is a symmetry that reflects one spatial direction instead of all spatial directions. So parity only makes sense in even dimensions. So I don't want to, for historical reasons, people may have only been interested in even dimensions in the past, but I don't want to make that restriction. So I'll always talk about CRT. Okay. So with the notational aside out of the way, so statement number one is that I'll assume that CRT is a symmetry in quantum gravity. Okay, so there are various justifications I could give for that. One is that it's certainly true in ADS CFT because you have a dual CFT, which is a quantum field theory, and quantum field theories obey the CRT theorem, so they have CRT symmetry. Another argument is that it's true in string perturbation theory. So if you're doing computing the string S matrix in any background that has a Minkowski space factor, then you can do a Euclidean rotation in the target space to get a CRT theorem to all orders in string perturbation theory. So of course, this is not a proof, right? Because we don't know what the true theory of quantum gravity is in our world, but at least in the quantum gravity theories that we like, CRT seems to be a symmetry. So I would be pretty surprised if it were violated in quantum gravity. On the other hand, we also think it's true that in quantum gravity, there are no global symmetries. So there are various arguments to that. I think actually going back to Sakharov, maybe in the 70s, or maybe Zel'dovich, I forget, one of the two. There was a heuristic argument based, at least when the symmetry is continuous, there's a heuristic argument based on black hole evaporation, which I don't think is original to this paper, but you can read it in this paper by Banks and Seiberg. Hiroshi and I argued more carefully that it's true in ADS CFT, including for the case of discrete symmetries, including space-time inversions. With Edgar, we argued that for this island picture of unitary black hole evaporation, at least if we assume that that's correct, then it also implies there are no global symmetries. So in this talk, I'm not really going to discuss these two assumptions more. We're just going to take them as given. But then there seems some tension at least, right? And the only way to resolve this tension is to say that CRT has to be a gauge symmetry, okay? Because gauge symmetries are allowed in quantum gravity. In some sense, gauge symmetries are just redundancies of description. So how can a redundancy of description not be allowed? That's not quite all they are, because for example, in the dual CFT, a gauge symmetry in the bulk leads to something real in the boundary, okay? But that seems fine. And more generally, so I phrase this in terms of CRT because CRT is always a symmetry, but if you happen to have some other space-time symmetry, inversion symmetry, like just T by itself or R by itself or CT or something like that, then that has to be gauged too. And so the goal of this talk is to understand what it means to gauge space-time inversions. So by the way, I like questions. So I have, I think, only 25 slides. So feel free to interrupt me or raise your hand or whatever if you have questions or comments.
So one question, just because you're going to keep saying it. When you say inversion, you just mean a Z2 symmetry, or do you actually mean that like an inversion in embedding space, or like, sorry, an inversion on the CFT is an embedding space reflection?
No, I just mean really parity and time reversal, or R and time reversal. Some space-time symmetry that inverts space or time or both. Yeah, so So now I should say, so in Euclidean signature, there's a long history of gauging parity, going back to the unoriented string world sheet. So often we say that to get from oriented string theory to unoriented string theory, you gauge world sheet parity, right? It says that in Polchinski. In Lorentzian signature, however, the concept is more confusing, especially if you gauge any symmetry that involves time reversal. That seems to lead to some alarming consequences, and understanding those is going to be the goal of this talk. So in Euclidean signature, things seem more conventional, but you know, in the end, we live in Lorentzian signature. That's where stuff happens, and so we need to understand this in Lorentzian signature. So for example, if T is a gauge symmetry, then we should allow time unorientable spacetimes to be considered physical. So for example, here's one which is called the Lorentzian Mobius strip. So this is a 1+1 dimensional Lorentzian manifold where you go around a spatial circle, and then when you come back to where you started, time is going in the other direction. So you see, I do this identification of the two sides of the strip, but with opposite time orientation. So that's kind of weird, right? I mean, why doesn't this lead to causal pathologies? You could immediately ask, and you could even ask, does it even make sense to talk about doing quantum field theory in a spacetime like this? And in fact, in the literature, there are claims that it doesn't, which I'll review a little bit later. If those claims are really right, then we really do seem to have some sort of problem here, right? Because somehow quantum gravity is telling us we have to include these things. And then if you can't even do field theory on them, you know, what is going on? Okay. So another puzzle, which we'll talk about, get back to at the very end, comes up when you think about the Hilbert space of quantum gravity in a closed universe. So like say that space is a closed three sphere. So any symmetry which reverses time is represented on Hilbert space by an anti-unitary operator theta. Okay, that statement's not quite always true. So if, before somebody gives me a hard time, but for theories that are basically the exception is if the spectrum of the Hamiltonian is invariant around h equals zero. But that's not a true feature of the world as we understand it. And if it's not, then time reversal symmetries have to be anti-unitary. But in a closed universe, all physical states should be gauge invariant, essentially by Gauss's law on electromagnetism or by this sort of discrete generalization of Gauss's law for discrete symmetries. But this leads to a puzzle for CRT or for any anti-unitary symmetry, because if psi is a state that's invariant under the anti-unitary symmetry, then I times psi is not invariant, because if I act on it with theta, when I move theta past I, I get a minus sign. So more generally, what this means is that the set of theta invariant states forms a real vector space. Mm-hmm. So since CRT reverses time, right, and by our assumption, it's always gauged, always a symmetry, what we learn from this is that the Hilbert space of quantum gravity in a closed universe seems like it should be real. And that's kind of weird, right? How is that consistent with quantum mechanics, right? You know, what I learned in quantum mechanics class is that the Hilbert space is complex. You know, many things that we like in quantum mechanics seem to rely on the Hilbert space being complex. So what are we supposed to make of this? Okay, so this is another puzzle that we're going to need to understand. So in this talk, I'm going to explain in more detail what it means to gauge a space-time inversion symmetry, focusing in Lorentzian signature. So here's kind of the plan for the rest of the talk. So first, we'll review the gauging of discrete internal symmetries. So people who do that all day can just ignore that part, go to sleep. Then we'll talk about background gauge fields for space-time inversions in quantum field theory. So the first step to gauging is to turn on a background gauge field. Then you sum over it to gauge it, right? I'll present an example from ADS CFT where we'll see that time unorientable geometries need to be included to be consistent with calculations in the dual CFT. So this is just to kind of force it on you if you're continuing to resist. And then we'll talk about quantum mechanics in a closed universe. This is based on this paper from last month with Takiro Numasawa. Okay, so any questions about the introduction before we go into the details. Everyone's happy. Everyone's confused. So I sometimes joke that, you know, in this talk, already you see in the first five slides, I've violated both causality and quantum mechanics. So, you know, if you want to, you know, sign off and protest, you know, feel free. Sorry, since I'm not there in person, you can't dramatically storm out. But okay. So then let's go on to the review for internal symmetries. Okay. So what does it mean to have a background gauge field for a internal symmetry? Well, in general, right, what it means is that you have a connection. So if the space-time is M and the symmetry group is G, the global symmetry group, then a background gauge field is a connection on a principal G bundle over M. Okay, in general, that's the rule. In the discrete case, that simplifies a bit. So what you need is just a rule that assigns a holonomy, you know, a symmetry transformation to each loop in M. So if you take a particle that's charged, or an operator that's charged under the symmetry, and move it around a loop, which is not contractible, then or even if it is contractible, what you want to know is, does it come back to itself, or does it come back to itself only up to a symmetry transformation? And if it doesn't come back to itself, then that's a non-trivial background for the symmetry. So more formally, you can say this mathematically. So a discrete background gauge field is a homomorphism from the fundamental group of M to the symmetry group G. It has to be a homomorphism because if I go around this loop and then around that loop, then I should just multiply the holonomies because that's how holonomies work. Now that's not quite true. You have to, at least if G is non-abelian, you have to do an equivalence relation because you can do a gauge transformation at the base point of the loop. And so you have to identify two homomorphisms if they differ just by conjugation by an element of G. Okay. So this is why, to get some, you know, in the non-abelian case, you have to take the trace of the holonomy to get the Wilson loop, which is gauge invariant. Okay. Any questions about that? Everyone's happy? Okay. So that was a bit formal. In practice, the way that you implement a background gauge field is that there's a symmetry operator U of G that implements the symmetry on the Hilbert space. It's a codimension one operator. And the idea is that if you want to have a holonomy, say, going around this circle, then you should wrap U of G on a D minus one cycle, which is dual to the holonomy loop that you're going to go around. Okay, and so in general, you have to wrap these for each of the generators of pi one of them. And you can see how this generates a holonomy, right? Because if I take a local operator here and I try to pull it around the circle, it gets stuck on the symmetry operator. And so if I want to move it past the symmetry operator, I have to kind of break off a piece of the symmetry operator that rides along with the operator. And then when I get back here, that piece is still there. And so that piece is exactly what implements the symmetry transformation on O. So O goes to D of G times O, where D is some representation of the symmetry group G. Now I want to emphasize for future reference, because this will come up again, that in the situation where it's a background gauge field that I constructed in this way, I can actually detect the location of this surface U of G by using charge operators, right? There will be a surface in the space where when I go across that, the operator transforms. So in that sense, this construction has a little bit more information than just this homomorphism I mentioned on the previous slide, because it knows the location of the brain. However, when you gauge the symmetry, that extra information goes away. And so what you're summing over in the gauge theory are really just the homomorphisms. Okay. Still waiting. I'll try to, please feel free to complain or speak up if you want to ask about something. Okay, so indeed, now let's gauge the symmetry. So we want to sum over background gauge fields. And then we have to divide by the volume of the group. So let's do this, so that it's, you know, it's been kind of formal so far. So let's do it for an example. So let's say that our manifold is T2. So here I'll be Euclidean for a sec. And let's say the group is a Z2. Okay, so I have some Z2 internal symmetry acting on a two-dimensional quantum field theory that I want to study on the torus. So then there are four terms that I need to sum over, four background gauge fields. And then I divide by two because that's the volume of the gauge group. So there's a term where there's no symmetry operator wrapping either cycle. There's no holonomy. That's kind of the trivial background gauge field. There's a piece where I extend the symmetry operator in the spatial direction. Okay, and so that gives a time holonomy for the Z2 symmetry. So these two terms together give a projection onto singlets in the original Hilbert space of the theory. But then there's two more terms where I wrap the U of G operator in the time direction. So that corresponds to computing a trace in a twisted sector, where as you go around the circle, the field doesn't come back to itself. It comes back to itself acted on with the Z2. And then finally, there's a term where I have the U's in both directions. And so this is a case where in the twisted sector, I also have a holonomy in the time direction. And so these third and fourth terms together project onto the invariant states in the twisted sector. Okay. So for people who remember the string worldsheet and so on, this is very familiar. Now I want to emphasize, although I'm not going to, this issue won't come up again, that you see in the fourth term, there's an intersection of the two surface operators. So you could worry about whether there's some UV issue happening there when the operators intersect each other. And in general, there can be. So you need to have a consistent rule for defining what you do with this intersection. And if there isn't a consistent rule, then we say the symmetry has an anomaly and you can't do the sum. Okay, so the symmetry can't be gauged. So that was explained this way in a nice paper by Xu Heng and Yinshin Lin. So some examples, so as I mentioned, right, you can have the compact scalar and do an orbifold. So that's the probably most familiar example from string theory. When you try to look at the Ising CFT, right, what's really meant by, so people sometimes say the Ising CFT is a free fermion, free Majorana fermion, but that's not really correct. It's a free Majorana fermion with fermion parity being gauged. And so this sum over things here has to do with, so these here would be called the Ramon sector. These here would be called the Nevis-Schwartz sector. And you have to sum over them if you actually want to get the Ising model. Maybe in more modern language, you would say you sum over spin structure. Okay.
Can you comment on what you would do in higher D? Just because like, I think at some point when you're going to wick rotate, like the time direction versus the spatial directions are not going to be.
Exactly. So if you go to higher dimensions, then there are more spatial directions. And so now you can have more, you can have like, for example, if you do T3 instead of T2, then there's two possible spatial holonomies and you need to make a rule for both of them.
So it's always pi one though. It's not like it's like other cycles, like if it's S3.
It's always pi one. That's right. Yeah, because I'm doing zero form symmetries here. So if I did higher form symmetries, which I'm not going to discuss in this talk, then it would be the higher cycles that matter. Good. So that's the review. Now let's start trying to say more novel things. I'll first talk about R, spatial reflection, because that's a little bit less confusing than going straight to time reversal. So I'll briefly discuss the general rules towards the end of the talk, and I want to first go just by analogy to the case of the internal symmetry. For concreteness, I'll consider a free scalar field of 1+1 dimension. So this is just so we can write concrete formulas and not be too formal. Reflection symmetry I'll take to be implemented by a unitary operator UR, where when you act on the field, which I'll remember the field will be quantized on a spatial circle of circumference L. So it just sends phi of t and x to phi of t minus x. Okay. And then because the periodicity, I could also write that on the right hand side, I could write phi of t comma L minus x, because I have the, you know, I can shift x by L and I get back to where I started because I'm on a circle. Okay, so fine, we have the symmetry. So let's first do the more conventional thing. So I can take this UR and I can insert it into the thermal trace. So what that says is, so as I go around the time circle, when I glue back to where I started in the thermal trace, I first do this reflection of the fields. Okay. So if you look at the picture, right, this is the partition function of the theory on the Klein bottle. Okay, so it's an unoriented space-time, which is kind of the thing that's familiar from the unoriented string, if you've thought about that, right? That somehow when you gauge world sheet parity, you should get unoriented Euclidean world sheets. And that's what we're seeing here. And then if you sum over the torus and the Klein bottle, then you get a projection onto R invariant states in the ungauged theory. Okay. So far, hopefully still somewhat familiar. Now things get funnier if you try to think about what the twisted states are. So that if you have a spatial holonomy for R, are there additional, does that make sense? Are there additional states that need to be included? So now if you look in Polchinski, he'll say that there aren't twisted states. I'm going to disagree with that in a sec, and I'll comment more on where the disagreement comes from. So what should we do to make a twisted state for R? What we want is a situation where if we go around the spatial circle, by X to X plus L, then we come back to ourselves, but now up to a parity transformation, which means, a R transformation. So I should come back with minus X instead of X here. Okay. Now, so that's just doing the same thing we did in the internal case. Here, however, this does something kind of surprising. So what this does is it removes half of the space-time. So we can take the half it removes to be the in between L over 2 and L. And then it introduces boundaries at the fixed points at X equals 0 and at X equals L over 2. Since it introduces boundaries, we can work out the boundary conditions. Okay, so they're Neumann boundaries. So let's see. So for example, at X equals 0, right, we can compute the derivative of X by just looking at phi on either side of 0 and then dividing by 2 epsilon. But then you see by this identification here, these things in the top cancel automatically. So I can remove the L here using the periodicity and then just cancel the two terms in the numerator, so I get 0. So in other words, in the string theory language, right, the twisted states that you get by gauging world sheet parity are open strings. And so that was suggested back in the 80s by Segnati and Harava. People fought about it in the past because they said that the unoriented string, if you study it at one loop, is modular without needing to include open strings. And their definition of twisted states back in the 80s was that twisted states are whatever you need to include to make the torus partition function modular. Okay. And so that's the definition that Joe is using. And by that definition, these are not twisted states. But to me, this is a pretty silly definition of twisted state. The right definition should be you have a spatial holonomy for the symmetry, and then you get the open string. So I agree with Segnati and Harava. That's all I was going to say about gauging R. So any further questions about that?
So can I reinterpret that as saying that you don't want to imagine that there's a physical doubling of the space-time that is somehow the other image under the symmetry?
Yeah, so you can somehow, right, so you could try to go in the, you could try to put back the other half, but this condition tells you that the fields on this half are completely determined by the fields in that half. So they're not really independent degrees of freedom.
Sure, so can I put, like, maybe I'll ask the question again at the end. But say I imagined, like, I'm interested in a theory living on a Poincaré patch, mm-hmm. and I lift that to the embedding space, and I don't unwind the time direction. So I really just have two copies of the Poincaré patch, and I have, like, an S1 cross S3, or in my 4D case. Like, mm-hmm. can you kind of lift your story to that in a way where, like, the existence of the other Poincaré patch is somehow, like, changing what the CPT invariance looks like on one?
Well, I think there you're probably not. So there, I think when the symmetry is global, you do have the two sides. So you really have to gauge it to remove one of them. Otherwise, yeah, you could have two halves that are exchanged by the symmetry, and that's kind of more the usual story. Yeah, it's somehow it's only when you gauge that you get this thing where you can create a boundary of space-time. And so, of course, that's very different from an internal symmetry. You can't create a boundary of space-time by gauging an internal symmetry.
But maybe the boundary is interesting, right? If I wanted to try to like talk about like a scattering matrix or something like that, as opposed to just like correlators in the cylinders.
Maybe
like I want yeah. a quotient to. Yeah.
Yeah, I think in higher dimensions, you would call this boundary an end of the world brain. So yeah, I mean, the world sheet language is always confusing because you get confused about the world sheet and the target space. But so here where I'm really thinking of the target space. And so in higher dimensions, we would call this an end of the world brain. Yeah. Okay. All right. So now things are going to start getting crazy. So now we're going to try to do holonomy for time reversal, right? So that's what I already drew before, this Lorentzian Mobius strip. So in the free scalar theory, that means you have a boundary condition like this. So when you go around the spatial circle, when you come back now, you come back to yourself at the opposite time from where you started. So it's hard to, you know, it's a bit of a strange experience to imagine having for yourself. On the other hand, classically, in the relativity community, usually people criticize things like closed time-like curves because they say they don't have a good initial value problem. For this, though, the initial value formulation seems kind of fine, actually. So like if we look at the t equals zero slice and what this implies, what it says is that phi has to be periodic and phi dot has to be anti-periodic. Okay, so those are some restrictions, but it's not more restrictions than we had if we had just done the ordinary cylinder. Just in the ordinary cylinder, we wouldn't have this minus sign here in the derivative. Okay, so it's the same amount of initial data that we have for the ordinary Lorentzian cylinder. And in fact, you can write down a reasonable set of modes that you can use to accommodate this initial data. So here's a complete set of modes. Don't worry about the details. This is just in case you want to look at them. So for example, at t equals zero, the second line is zero. So we just have the first line, which is periodic. There's a typo here. I apologize. These t's here should be x's. That's what I get for making the slides this morning. Okay, so the here at the end, those are t's. Inside here, those are x's. I apologize. So these here is a periodic function of x. Whereas if we take the time derivative, then now this line goes away. We just get this line. And then these are anti-periodic because you see I shifted the frequencies by this a half. Okay.
Daniel,
can you hear me?
Hi.
Yes.
I'm confused by one thing. In the slides before, you said that the conditions you were giving are not a problem for the causality and closed time-like curves. But the second condition about phi dot, isn't that an issue? Because it's kind of telling you that the velocity in the future depends by the velocity on the past.
There are definitely going to be issues with causality. I'm not saying there are no issues. I'm just saying it's not as bad as closed time-like curves. I'll talk in a minute about the cause. I'm going to compute correlation functions in a minute and talk about the causal structure of this.
All right.
But it's not completely well-behaved, no.
Okay, thanks. Thank you.
So we have a fine set of solutions. You know, if we want to quantize, though, we need a phase space. And to get a phase space, we need a symplectic form. At this level, now there's a puzzle, which is the origin of the complaints in the literature about this before. So I'll say it in quantum language, because these days people know quantum mechanics better than they know Hamiltonian mechanics. So if you look at the commutator of phi and phi dot, right, that should be equal to I times the delta function, okay. But which direction should this time derivative be taken in, right? Because as you go around the circle here, it flips, right? So this commutation relation is not smooth as you go around the circle, right? There has to be a discontinuity at some point in your definition of which direction is phi dot, okay. And so this is the thing that in the relativity literature people have complained about in the past. Our approach, though, is just to accept the discontinuity by interpreting it as the location of the symmetry brain, right? The symmetry defect, right? Because we had an operator that's stretching in the time direction. And even in the case of the internal symmetry, right, we saw that the correlators were discontinuous as we crossed the brain because the operators that were charged picked up a symmetry transformation. So similarly here, we should be willing in the case of a background field to tolerate a discontinuity as we cross a codimension one surface. The important thing is that once we gauge the symmetry, the location of the surface becomes invisible. And that will be true here, right? Because phi dot is not gauge invariant. And so if we compute under time reversal, and if we compute only commutators of things that are T invariant, then there won't be any discontinuities. Okay. And so I say they were too dismissive of this. It's really not actually a problem. So that constructs the theory, right? The Hilbert space is the set of wave functionals of phi on which the canonical momentum flips sign as you cross this brain at x equals zero. So it's a normal Hilbert space. On the other hand, there is a novel feature, which is that there's no particularly nice state in the Hilbert space to think about. You can, of course, construct whatever state you want. But in particular, this geometry doesn't have time translation symmetry, right, because of the identification. So there's no ground state, right? There's no Hamiltonian that's conserved that we can define a ground state for. So then what do we do? Like, what do we compute, right, if we just have a Hilbert space with no particularly nice state to think about in it? Well, I mean, that happens also in De Sitter space, for example. There's not a time translation symmetry in De Sitter space, but there we can use Euclidean gravity to prepare a state. So let's try to do that here. Let's try to use Euclidean path integral to define some sort of reasonably natural state. So what should we do? We can take the Euclidean path integral on the Euclidean Mobius strip and cut it at t equals zero to define an operator rho hat, you know, which is defined by matrix elements. There's phi initial and phi final here. And then we do the path integral over the shaded region. But then to get a state that's in this funny Hilbert space, we have to do the identifications like this. So this gets identified with that. And this gets identified with that. Unfortunately, this is not really a good state. So first of all, it's not a pure state because these identifications glue the bra and the ket together, right? So it's some sum over outer products of pure states. But in fact, not only is it mixed, it's not even a positive operator. So that may be not obvious here. I guess it's not obvious that it should be positive. And I'm claiming that in fact, it's not a positive operator. I'll show you more directly in a little bit that I'll give you a formula for this state and you can really see that it's not positive. So nonetheless, the state is still useful, but since it's not really a state, I'll call it a pseudo state. And in fact, I'll call it the Mobius pseudo state since I got it from the Euclidean path integral in the Mobius strip. Right? And so, okay, it's not a physical state, but it's still some natural object that we can use to compute things about the theory. So in fact, in the past, this lack of a natural state was also used in these papers as a further argument that quantum field theory and time unorientable backgrounds doesn't make sense. You know, because they tried to construct correlation functions and then they complained that the correlation functions that respected the symmetries weren't positive. Okay. But again, I want to emphasize though that in our way of thinking about this, this is not a sickness of the theory. The Hilbert space is fine, the operators are fine. It's just that there's no natural state that is very symmetric or has particularly nice properties, and we just have to learn to live with that. Okay. In particular, there's a nice thing you can compute, which is correlation functions in the Mobius pseudo state. So I won't call those observables because it's not a state. I'll call them computables, but then we can use them to diagnose the structure of the theory. So I don't want to drag you through the calculation of the correlators. I'll put some formulas here just to show you what they look like. These are Whiteman functions. So don't worry about the details of this. This is just to show you that you can actually do calculations. Now, the main lesson of the correlators, which I will tell you, and this gets back to the question that was asked before, is that they have conventional causal properties in a subset of the space, which is this gray diamond, which is basically the causal diamond, which you construct sitting on top of any spatial slice, but where you remove this point where the brain lives. So here the brain is living. So these two edges are identified. That's where the symmetry defect is living. And then I look at the sort of domain of dependence sitting on top of the slice, excluding that point. And in this gray shaded region, everything is good. I can do canonical quantization. Things obey the right commutation relations. And then if I want to extend the operators outside of this diamond, I have to do it by solving the Heisenberg equations. And I shouldn't necessarily get things that have simple causal properties. And in fact, one way to see that you shouldn't have simple causal properties is that this geometry has self-intersecting time-like curves. So this red curve is an example. So you come in from past infinity, you go out here, you come out here going backwards, and then you come back and meet yourself. It turns out you can never meet yourself in this shaded gray region, which is why the correlators behave well there. Outside of the shaded gray region, you can. So these correlators make sense everywhere, but they're causal properties are more puzzling outside of the gray region.
Okay. Can you specify again, is that dashed line is special because of what feature? Because I could just translate it up.
This dashed line is the t equals zero slice. So the t equals zero slice is special because it's the locus that's invariant under time reversal. I chose to do a different slice here just to emphasize that I don't have to pick that slice, that I can do any spatial slice in this diamond makes sense.
But that diamond centered around that slice though, so.
Yeah. This diamond is centered on this other slice that I picked. So to be a space-like slice, right, it has to start up here and end down there. That's the kind of funny thing in this geometry. Someone else had a comment?
Hi, it's Luke again. I have a question. How does it look like the time reversal and parity conditions on if you switch to the light cone coordinates?
I wrote it in light cone coordinates here, right?
Right. Yeah, because in the gray shape that you wrote, it looks like everything is fine, because when you convert to null coordinates, there may be some causality features that are better.
Yeah. So what happens is if you look at the singularities of these correlators, there are some weird singularities, but none of them happen in this gray region.
Right. And is it important that the black line should be up on the left and down in the right?
Yes, that's important because I want it to be a smooth spatial slice. So this point up here is identified with this point down there. If I went straight across, that wouldn't be a smooth spatial slice.
I see. Thank you.
And then I guess you're restricted.
Go ahead.
There's like only if you try to look at all the spatial slices that you could make, it's kind of like it doesn't extend very far along the time direction there, right?
Exactly right. Yeah. Like so there's a weird thing that like a point like down here is not on any spatial slice. Kind of weird, right?
Yeah.
Because somehow that spatial slice would have to make it all the way up here, and then it wouldn't be spatial.
Would it be reasonable to just exclude the geometries outside of anything you can reach from, like, the Cauchy slices? Or
I don't think so, because the Heisenberg operators make sense throughout the space-time. And a person who was living there would indeed just coast through up here. It's just an obstruction to trying to impose things like canonical quantization with commutativity at space-like separation on a slice up here. But we don't need to impose that. I can just construct the Hilbert space here on a slice where I am able to do canonical commutation relations. And then I just construct everything else by solving the Heisenberg equations. So it's probably safest to think that the Hilbert space always lives on slices like this.
Can I ask another question? Sorry, what's the I epsilon prescription you're choosing?
Yeah, so these are Whiteman functions. You can do other choices, but the word time ordering is a bit delicate here, so that's why I did Whiteman.
That's why I was asking. Thank you. Thanks. Yeah.
Okay. So in 2D CFT, we can actually give a rather explicit characterization of this Mobius pseudostate, right? So here's the idea. So this is how it was defined. I can just take the top half and sort of flip it over and plop it down next to the other state here. And then now you see these identifications look a lot nicer, right? So now these are going in the same direction. These are also going in the same direction. So this is just the ground state of the ordinary CFT on a cylinder, but now projected, the wave functional is computed in a bit of a funny way where on the right, I project onto phi f as normal, but on the left, I project onto the time reverse of phi I. Okay, so this is a formula for the pseudo state in terms of the ground state wave function of the theory on a circle that's twice as big. Okay. Now that's kind of abstract, so let me say it more explicitly. So what this says, so here's the explicit formula. So this pseudo state on the Mobius-Hilbert space is gotten by taking the, so this K cylinder is the modular Hamiltonian for half of the cylinder. So I do e to the minus pi k, where that's the cylinder, of, that's the modular Hamiltonian for half the cylinder. But then when you chase all this through, I have to multiply it by CRT and also by T. Okay, and so you can see explicitly that this is not a positive operator. It's a positive operator times a unitary operator because the product of two anti-unitaries is unitary, right? So this is special to 2D CFT. I have to do some conformal transformation to get this formula. So if it's not a CFT, this won't be true, but this is just so you can see concretely what the state looks like. All right. So far you may be thinking I'm crazy. I wouldn't necessarily blame you. What I'll now do is try to show you how these ideas can show up in the context of ADS CFT and where you sort of can't avoid them. This is a new thing. So if there are more questions about the Lorentzian Mobius strip, happy to. Okay. So let's just first remember. I'm going to do ADS 3 CFT2. Okay. So let's remember how the BTZ black hole works. So in Lorentzian signature, right, this is the Penrose diagram. So I'll work in crustal coordinates. So there's time going up this way and space at capital X going that way. It covers the whole geometry with the horizon here being at X equals T equals zero. And then in Euclidean signature, right, and then on top of this, there's a spatial circle sitting there because it's three-dimensional. And then over here, this is the Euclidean thing. So I have the disk with where I go a distance beta around. And then again, there's a circle sitting on top. And so on the left, what we usually do is we work in the Hartle-Hawking state, right, which is an entangled state between the two sides. We can compute correlators, whatever. Well, on the right, we use this to compute the thermal partition function, right? So the BTZ thermal partition function is the Euclidean action of this geometry, which in gravity variables is like this, e to the pi squared over 2g beta, where if you convert it to convert g Newton to the central charge of the dual CFT, then it's pi squared c over 3 beta. Okay, so this review of hopefully familiar things. Now, I'm going to construct a new sort of more obscene geometry, which I'll call the CRT twisted black hole. And the idea is I'm just going to do a Z2 quotient of BTZ, and here's the Z2 quotient. So I take this crustal T and X, and then phi is the angle on the circle. So I want to emphasize that the circle does not contract anywhere in BTZ except up at the singularities. Anywhere in the interior of this diagram or near the boundary, the circle is not contracted. And so I can do a quotient here where I flip T, I flip X, and I shift phi by pi. So if I didn't do this shift of phi by pi, then there would be a fixed point of this identification at X equals T equals zero. But since I shifted phi by pi, there are no fixed points. And so this gives a smooth asymptotically ADS Lorentzian manifold, whose asymptotic boundary is the usual Lorentzian cylinder. So here you can look if we can look at the pictures a little bit, right? So essentially what this does, so I can pick a fundamental domain, which is just the right half of BTZ. That's what I've done here. But then now there's this kind of funny surface on the left where, so there's not actually any singularity there. It's a smooth space time. But if I go into the upper half of this surface, I somehow come out in the lower half of it down here and on the other side of the circle, right? So this is a 2D picture. If I draw the whole geometry, it's a 3D picture. So this space-time, you can think of it as the solid cylinder here, but with a smaller cylinder removed in the middle. And then I do a sort of antipodal time reversing identification on this inner cylinder to get a smooth space-time. And so in fact, this dashed line here is just this dotted line here is just the Lorentzian Mobius strip that we were talking about before. So in particular, it's not time orientable and they're self-intersecting time-like curves. On the other hand, I want to emphasize that the boundary geometry is completely kosher. It's just the Lorentzian cylinder. So this glues into our favorite CFT boundary geometry. There's nothing weird in the CFT. We're just doing the Lorentzian cylinder. If you're going to tell me that I'm not allowed to include this geometry, you have to tell me why, because it seems to satisfy the rules that should glue into the Lorentzian cylinder. Now, as in the Lorentzian Mobius strip, we don't have a natural choice of state for this geometry, but there is a natural pseudo state. So I can take the Euclidean BTZ and do the same identification. It removes the left half of the disk and then does this funny identification here. I can put the initial and the final states there, so that defines some state. If you translate that into the boundary description, right, then there's the initial state lives here at this dot, at the edge of this line. The final state lives here. And then as I go here, I meet a rotation by pi on the circle, right? That comes from this identification here. And then I glue back down there. So if we write that out, the pseudo state in the dual CFT, it's just this story I said. So remember, it was beta to go all the way around. So to go from here to here is beta over 4. Then I rotate by pi on the spatial circle. And then I go back up here by another beta over 4. And since H and J commute, I can rewrite it like this. So you see that again, I have a positive operator times a unitary. But now this is a pseudo state in the dual CFT. So this is definitely an object that we're allowed to consider. So actually we can check that this pseudo state is indeed dual in the bulk to this CRT twisted black hole. And we can test it in two different ways. So I'll show you both. So the first thing we can do is we can just compute the trace, right? So we can compute the trace of this e to the minus beta over 2h, e to the I pi j. So in the bulk, the calculation is easy, right? Because the geometry is just half of the BTZ geometry. So we should just divide the action by 2 or take the square root of the partition function. So remember, for BTZ, we had this pi squared c over 3 beta. So for this CRT twisted black hole, we get pi squared c over 6 beta. Okay, easy enough. We can do the CFT calculation as well. So here's why it's nice that we're in ADS3 CFT2, so we can do cardiology. So this quantity that we're computing, right, the trace of e to the minus beta h over 2 times e to the I pi j, is it's just the torus partition function, but with a complex structure parameter tau. So tau is 1/2 plus I beta over 4 pi. So just for simplicity, let's call beta over 4 pi epsilon, since we're interested in the high temperature limit where beta is small. Okay. All right, so now let's do the computation. Okay, so here's the fun. So we just do a bunch of modular transformations. So we want to compute with tau is 1/2 plus I epsilon. Well, we can do tau goes to minus 1 over tau. Okay, then since epsilon is small, we can Taylor expand in epsilon to get minus 2 plus 4 I epsilon. Then we can do the T transformation twice to get rid of the minus 2. Then we can do the S again to go to minus 1 over 4 I epsilon, or just I over 4 epsilon. But now this is a low temperature partition function on the circle with no tilting or anything. So it's controlled by the Casimir energy, which is we know in any CFT. And so it's just this e to the pi squared c over 6 beta, which of course matches with the bulk. Okay, and so this really shows that this CRT twisted black hole is the dominant saddle contributing to the CFT partition function. So let me emphasize, right, you could have looked at this and said, oh, this is some analytically continued rotating black hole with imaginary chemical potential, right? That's maybe a more conventional, time orientable saddle you could have guessed. That one turns out to be subleading to this one, right? So we really need this time unorientable one to match the CFT. We can also do a more direct Lorentzian calculation by comparing the Whiteman two-point function. So this is like the correlator that I was computing before. So of course, in the Ising CFT, all the correlate. So well, let me mention the Ising in a sec. So first, we do the holographic calculation using the method of images. Okay. Then we want to compare to the dual CFT. So what actually we do is we just compare to the Ising CFT because at high temperature, this correlator should be universal. And indeed, you can see here. So the solid lines here are the bulk calculation, literally of this type I showed before in the pseudo state with the Whiteman function. In Lorentzian signature, and the dashed lines are the same correlator in the Ising model. Here, and I plot both the real and imaginary parts of the correlator, and you can see that at high temperature, they match pretty well. If you don't want to do this detour through Ising, you can probably also do this using the Torres-Virasoro identity block, but I'm not good enough at 2D CFT to do that, so we just compare to Ising. Someone who's good at conformal blocks could probably do that in an afternoon. So that's all I had to say about the ADS CFT example. Any questions about this? All right, so I interpret this as saying, you know, these weird geometries are here to stay. We're going to have to learn to live with them. Now just for more mathematically oriented people, I want to make one slide comment about the general story for how to gauge R and T. So far we've just done a bunch of examples, you know, inspired by analogy to the internal symmetry. Was there a
question about the previous discussion on ADS? Yeah. So is there a Euclidean saddle, Euclidean geometry that's a continuation of the identification that you discussed? The one whose action is half of the ordinary BTZ?
It's the, in some sense, right. I mean, I got it by taking the Euclidean BTZ, which isn't a continuation of BTZ, and then doing this quotient. So it's a Euclidean geometry that satisfies the boundary conditions.
Okay, yeah.
There are other ones you could construct, like this analytically continued rotating BTZ, but those are subleading. So somehow the time unoriented one is the one you have to live with. So let me just comment briefly on the general case for how to gauge R and T. So I won't explain fermions in this talk. You can go look in the paper if you want to learn about fermions. So first I want to say that the gauging of R and T, I think, only really makes sense in gravitational theories. So far I discussed background fields in quantum field theory, right? And until I got to ADS CFT. But if you tried to gauge them in quantum field theory, it would break Lorentz symmetry because R and T don't commute with the Lorentz group. And so if you gauge them, you'll break Lorentz symmetry. So unless you gauge Lorentz symmetry as well, and of course that's just doing gravity. Now the organizing principle, and I won't try to justify this in general, but just so you can hear the words for how to think about this is what we're really talking about here is the structure group of the tangent bundle. So in any Lorentzian manifold, right, you can use the metric to reduce the structure group from GL D minus 1 comma 1 to O D minus 1 comma 1, where this is the set of all linear transformations that preserve the Minkowski metric. So this group has four connected components having to do with the identity component, the component that has R, the component that has T, and the component that has RT. So it's natural to ask if you can reduce the structure group further, so that the gluing functions as you go from patch to patch have to, say, preserve the space orientation or the time orientation. And there are five possibilities for what rule you make for gluing as you go from patches to patches. So R and CT could both be gauged. R and CT could both not be gauged. You could have R gauged, but not CT, CT gauged, but not R, or CT gauged, but not, or sorry, that should be CRT gauged, but not R or CT separately. Sorry, that's a typo. There should be CRT here. So actually all these possibilities make sense and they constrain what kinds of geometries we include. So really this choice of whether or not you gauged R and CT and whatever is a choice of what gluing is allowed in the structure group of the tangent bundle. Okay. In Euclidean signature, the OD minus 1 comma 1 is instead OD, which has only two connected components. So CRT is automatically gauged since it's in the identity component. That's kind of the novel difference between Euclidean and Lorentzian signature. So the only choice is whether or not R and CT are both gauged or neither gauged. So in more conventional language, that choice is, do we include unoriented manifolds or not? And so that's what is familiar from the string world sheet in Euclidean signature. The Lorentzian situation is more complicated, as I just said. So as usual, Euclidean gravity seems to know things that Lorentzian gravity doesn't know, which is that CRT must be gauged.
Wait, could you turn that around though and say that anytime you're analytically continuing from Euclidean, then you're forcing CRT to be gauged, but like Lorentzian could have just not done it and you're just stuck in your Euclidean continuation?
Yeah, that's right. But somehow something we've learned over and over again is that Euclidean seems to be smarter. So, you know, Euclidean gravity seems to know things that Lorentzian gravity doesn't know, like it knows the page curve of the black hole and it knows the black hole entropy and so on. So probably Euclidean gravity is right that CRT should be gauged. And indeed that, you know, from the no global symmetry point of view, that's clear, right? So in some sense, in most of these Lorentzian cases, you have global symmetries, you know, unless the symmetries are explicitly broken. And so somehow those shouldn't really be allowed. And somehow Euclidean gravity knows some of that, is how I would think about it.
Can you point to a particular example where, like, you know that the physics, like, sorry, like, can you see strictly for the Lorentzian side that something that wouldn't be able to be continued from Euclidean is actually the right physics as opposed to it knows it because it enforces it, you know, like.
No, I don't know an example of that. I mean, yeah, of course. So I can do, by Lorentzian here, what I really mean is canonical quantization, you know, right? And I can do canonical quantization, and I can do canonical quantization of theories that have global symmetries, right? That's fine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not renormalizable, but it's okay. I can view it as an effective field theory. And in all five of these possibilities are allowed there. So the fact that some of them aren't really allowed is some deep constraint from non-perturbative quantum gravity. It's saying that some of these are in the swampland, if you like. Any of them that have a global symmetry. Okay, let me just briefly comment on quantum cosmology. This is the last thing I was going to say, so we'll basically end on time, sorry. So here I'll just again get back to the puzzle I had at the beginning. So in a closed universe, physical states have to be gauge invariant. And so in electromagnetism, right, this comes from Gauss's law, same is true for discrete symmetries. For anti-unitary symmetries, this has this funny consequence, right? Here's another typo, sorry, the catch should be closed here. So psi and phi are linearly independent CRT invariant states. Then if I act on a linear combination of them, right, the linear combination will only be CRT invariant if A and B are real. And so in other words, the Hilbert space of quantum gravity in a closed universe is real. Although this seems like a trivial argument, I think it's actually probably a powerful constraint on any attempt to make a holographic dual of cosmology in a closed universe, because you need to get a real vector space. Somehow that has to be baked into the theory from the beginning, which I think is a rather novel idea, you know, very powerful if it, I mean, now it might be that quantum gravity in a closed universe just doesn't make sense or have a holographic dual, I don't know, but if it does, it seems like this constraint should apply. On the other hand, you can immediately ask why this doesn't destroy quantum mechanics. That's what I said before, right? Like most presentations of quantum mechanics, the phases are important, for example, in the double slit algorithm, experiment or Shor's algorithm. Of course, it doesn't destroy quantum mechanics. And it goes back to it. The reason is that it goes back to this old issue in quantum cosmology that in quantum cosmology, you need a clock. So let's say given some state psi and some state chi, which live in a system S, I introduce an additional clock variable C, and then I prepare a state which consists of a superposition of the clock going. So here, the clock here is very simple. It just tells me whether clock time is going forward or backwards. So that for me, that's enough to deal with time reversal or CRT. So if time is going forward, I say the system is in the state psi. But then if the time is going backwards, I say the system is in the time reverse of psi. So this is a CRT invariant state. Similarly, I can define a CRT invariant observable, which says that if the clock is going forward, I do the projection to see if I'm in chi. Whereas if the clock is going backwards, then I look to see if I'm in the state is the time reverse of chi. So this is, again, a CRT invariant projector. So now both these things act on a real Hilbert space. And yet, if I follow the rules of quantum mechanics, right, I compute the expectation value of the projector in the state psi, I just get back the Born rule for psi and chi in the complex Hilbert space of the subsystem, okay? So somehow by adding a degree, one degree of freedom, you know, one qubit, I can turn the complex Hilbert space of quantum mechanics into a real vector space. I can just sort of embed it, okay? Now that sounds like bookkeeping. So what, Daniel? You just fine, that's bookkeeping, okay. But actually I would claim it's not. And the reason is that the clock actually needs to be part of the system. So this calculation I just did here is only approximate, right? I can't really define a CRT symmetry that acts just on the system and the clock separately because there'll be interactions between the two. So it's only in the limit that the universe is infinitely big that this calculation that I just did is really correct. When the universe is finite, they're corrections to this calculation, and really they're corrections to quantum mechanics because they come from the fact that, you know, in finite volume, the real system has a real Hilbert space. Okay, so it's kind of surprising. Of course, we're not going to measure these corrections, you know, in practice because the universe is very big, but in principle, as a constraint on the holographic dual, I think it's important. All right. I also had a comment, I'll just say this very fast. So in quantum cosmology, there's this old fight about whether you should use the Harlan-Hawking or the Vilenkin wave function of the universe. Harlan and Hawking say you should sum over expanding and contracting branches with equal weights. Vilenkin says expanding branch only. So the arguments on both sides, I think, are not very convincing, which is why they keep fighting. But the gauging of CRT comes strongly down on the side that says you should do Harlan-Hawking. Because only Hartle-Hawking is CRT invariant. Okay, so that's just an aside. Now let me conclude. So we've learned, I think, hopefully, several interesting things, at least I've learned. So one is that gauging spatial reflections introduces boundaries of space-time, which in string theory are open strings. So that idea was sort of floating around in the 80s. I think they didn't really have this modern language of gauging discrete symmetries, but I think it's correct. Quantum field theory makes sense on backgrounds that are not time-orientable but doesn't have a preferred state, but we just accept that. In ADS CFT, it's necessary to include time-unorientable geometries to match boundary CFT calculations. And in a closed universe, the Hilbert space of quantum gravity is real. Okay, so I'll stop there. Thanks for the invitation. Sorry I couldn't come in person.
Thank you, Hardo. Any questions?
Hi, can you hear me? It's still me.
Hey,
I have another question. Would you, in 3D, the time unorientable geometries for ADS3, I mean, you got around the problem of gravitational propagation of degrees of freedom, right? But in 4D, what would you have in mind? So do you have in mind some accelerated black hole where I cannot time reverse, like a Robinson-Friedman?
No, you can do the same thing. If you look at this identification, to do it in higher dimensions, I should just replace this shift by pi by the antipodal map on the sphere. So in fact, this geometry in 3+1 dimensions is the thing that Atuft talks about when he wants to do the antipodal map of the Schwarzschild geometry. I think he doesn't understand what he's doing with that map, but here I would say that what he should really be doing with that map is there's some formula like this, which is true, where you have this, and then here, instead of e to the I pi j, you have the antipodal map. Now, there's a subtlety in 4 dimensions, which is that the antipodal map on the 2 sphere is orientation reversing, which means that the theory needs to have parity symmetry. So in odd dimension like ADS3, I can use CRT. That's why I call it CRT twisted black hole. But in even dimensions, it's something like CRT times P or something, or it's more like the CT twisted black hole or something. So then
And is it obvious
you
that
it, like you couldn't do it in the standard model, for example, right? Because the standard model doesn't have parity symmetry.
But is it obvious that the CRT plus P should be a symmetry then to begin
no,
with?
No, it's not, right? No, and then okay. You can't do this. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So it's kind of less interesting in even dimensions. In I five see. Dimensions, it's okay again. But in even dimensions, you need parity symmetry for this construction to make sense.
I see. Thank you. Mm-hmm.
If there are no further questions, you can thank Daniel, and then anybody who wants to bother him informally, we can do the MIT style.
As you like. I guess I should also let everyone have lunch before the next talk.
Oh, yeah, I think there's enough time. It's like 2 hours. So I'm still interested if I can ask, I think it's a very biased question, so it's not going to be about what you're studying, but why I want to understand from it. Can we understand what implications you would have for just looking at, say, your theory living on an Einstein cylinder and what it would mean for if I tried to quotient to some single Poincaré patch or the physics in that patch?
When you say the Einstein cylinder, you mean the Einstein static universe, S3
yeah.
times R?
So I'm thinking of my S3 cross R. And then sometimes I'm interested in physics just in one Poincaré patch on that cylinder. And I don't mind if it's just look in the boundary CFT versus, or we can go to the bulk if you wanted to make your quantum gravity statement. But
yeah. Well, I would say that's quantum gravity in a closed universe, so the Hilbert space should be real. That's certainly one thing I would say. I guess yeah. With parity, I guess I have less to say about parity there because S3 doesn't have one cycles where I could try to invert parity as I go around them. So there's kind of only the time cycles. So I need to project onto invariant states, but that's kind of it.
No, but so for me, I guess one question I would have is if I wasn't on S3 cross R, but I was somehow in S3 cross S1, and then I wanted to mod Z2 to talk about physics in one Poincaré patch. To what extent, by having a physical, image space-time, how that would interplay with statements you're saying about gauging. Can I view the gauging as literally saying that I really want to be able to look at physics on that quotient?
Yeah, I guess, yeah, the thing is, I think it's better in the long run not to think about global quotients of the geometry, but rather this language of the structure group, where it's whether the symmetry is gauged is really about what gluings are allowed as you go from patch to patch. It's a local criterion. So because if you do it, you can generate interesting spacetimes by doing quotients of other spacetimes as long as they're freely acting, right?
Yeah.
But in general, I wouldn't think those have a particularly natural interpretation of saying this quotient comes from gauging exactly that particular symmetry. That was kind of true in these examples because I picked simple examples to get started. But the real rule is this local gluing condition. So in particular, as long as what you construct is time orientable and space orientable, then I would say it's allowed even if parity and time reversal are not gauged. The novel thing when you gauge them is that you allow these things that are not time orientable or not space orientable or not space time orientable.
Yeah, and for you, that's valuable because you want to see that quantum gravity enforces you to have all of them for some sort of at least in the 2D CFT case, the modular invariance of the boundary.
Yeah. Well, you have kind of two choices, right? Because so quantum gravity, so you're not allowed, for example, T is not allowed to be a global symmetry. But it has two options. It can either be a gauge symmetry or it can just not be a symmetry, right? And in the standard model, for example, it's just not a symmetry. as far as we know. I suppose in principle it could be Higgs in some sense, but and we wouldn't know. But at least at low energies, it's not a symmetry. So, you know, CRT is more interesting because I think you don't get to say it's not a symmetry. It has to be a symmetry.
Now, when you say that it's a real, sorry, maybe this is jumping a little bit. When you say that the Hilbert space is real, are you kind of saying that there's like only one unique like CRT invariant state? And so like I don't run into double slit experiment questions because those are not, but those are excitations of the vacuum that are not themselves CRT invariant.
No, there's more than one state. No, there's a, yeah. So there's some characterization of anti-unitary operators.
Yeah.
Which is basically that if you have an anti-unitary operator, then you can find a basis for the Hilbert space where some of the basis states are just invariant. And then there are other basis states that come in pairs that just kind of get exchanged by the anti-unitary operator, or you know, acted on with, basically they're, you know, acted with some phase.
Yeah, so, Wall runs into that, right?
Yeah, maybe. So then when you go to CRT invariant states, what is left are real superpositions of the basis states that are invariant. So it's not one dimensional, right? You can have a bunch of basis states that are invariant, and then real superpositions of those will also be invariant. You're just not allowed to do complex superpositions.
But you could still do, like, if I want to do an EFT on this background or something like that, I can do complex superpositions of all like the other quantum matter fields, or you're saying that this is...
Well, you can, as long as you can't, right. You can't, what you can do is you can entangle them with the clock, right? That's what I was showing. So a state that's allowed is the clock is going forward and you have some state plus the clock going backward and the time reverse of the state. So that's not a superposition of the state and its time reverse. It's an entangled state with a clock. And so somehow the claim is that's all that's allowed. And somehow that's enough, right? So that you can reproduce the double slit experiment and so on by just having the clock around. So I mean, maybe it helps to make an analogy to E&M. So like you could say we live in a closed universe, right? You might want to know about 2-2 electron scattering. But there's a problem because there's no physical states with 2 electrons in a closed universe. So in order to make a 2-electron state,
image,
2 positrons or somewhere else in the universe, you know, hopefully far away. And then I can have the 2 electrons scatter and see what comes out. But if the universe is finite, there will be corrections to that know about the positrons. Because there will be some Coulomb field from the positrons that will affect what happens. And it's only in the limit that the universe is infinitely big that I can move the positrons off to infinity. So the clock here is like the positrons.
But for that guy, what I would try to do is take, like, so again, kind of back to the toy model, like I would have my S3 and think of living in one Poincaré patch and maybe have the image charges always in the other Poincaré patch. Right? And so then I have a closed universe where everything is neutral, but like the physics within the one can see just the 2 electrons. And then the role of, instead of a clock, it's like there's a second half.
That's right. But there's a Wilson line that, one way you can think about it is there's an electric flux that goes from the electron in one half to the positron in the other. So what you don't have is an operator living just in the half that makes the electron.
And then we're fine with that because then there's some cool edge stuff at Scry or whatever, seeing the electric field inside them.
Yeah, that's right. So there's some edge mode at the cut, right? And so basically you can put the clock that way, right? Like if you want to, so you can say once you have a boundary, you can sort of always put the clock in the boundary.
Yeah.
And somehow, you can try to hide. I mean, that's how you, right. So then when you look locally, you think that you can have charged states. It's the same idea. It's a bit related also to what kinetic matter physicists call fractionalization, I think. It would be nice if I could make some like prediction for the CMB or something, but you know, this is all unfortunately, everything is suppressed by powers of the de Sitter entropy, so good luck.
I'm curious what kind of question Davide would ask you, like even though, like just generally. Davide. No.
Davide knows everything already.
Can I ask a question?
Sure. Who is that?
Oh, it's me, David. Could you maybe explain in what sense Euclidean quantum gravity is force? Like, if I just write down a gravitational path integral, is there some way of seeing that these unorientable manifolds need to be included in the summation?
Well, so yeah, sorry, we have to think, so we have to distinguish between CRT and R or CT here. So in Euclidean signature, CRT is part of the identity component of the Lorentz group. So you know that? Because it's a rotation by pi. So okay. It's continuously connected to the identity. So if you're doing a gravitational theory where you sum over metrics, you have to gauge the identity component of diffs of the Lorentz group, because otherwise you have the wrong number of propagating gravitons and negative norm states and so on. And since you can build CRT out of a bunch of infinitesimal rotations, then it has to be gauged as well. So Euclidean gravity knows that sort of automatically. What it doesn't know is whether or not you should include unoriented manifolds. So from the Lagrangian point of view, if you only include the oriented ones, then you're treating R, or equivalently CT, as a global symmetry. If you include the unoriented one, so the thing is, since CRT is automatically gauged, then R is only a symmetry if CT is a symmetry, and the you can either gauge both or neither. You can't just gauge one because their product is gauged. If you include unoriented geometries, then you're gauging both R and CT, and if you include only oriented geometries, then you're gauging CRT but neither R nor CT. Which is a bit weird that you can have two global symmetries whose product is a gauge symmetry. That's related to this fractionalization that I mentioned. From the point of view of Euclidean gravity, that's just a choice. So the case that has a global symmetry, right, which is the case where you don't include unoriented geometries, is allowed. And so it has to be fixed by some more non-perturbative effect. Which actually happens, for example, in this connection between JT gravity and matrix models. I don't know how much you know about that, but in the case where you do only oriented spacetimes, you have a UN, it's dual to a UN matrix ensemble, and then the time reversal symmetry is a symmetry of the ensemble, but it's broken by the elements of the ensemble. So sort of in a individual quantum gravity theory in the ensemble, T is broken. Somehow that's what has to happen, is if you don't gauge R or CT, then they just have to be broken non-perturbatively.
All right, thank you. There was one question also about, I guess, cardiology and higher dimensions. I was wondering if you could say more about that.
Well, cardiology is not so good in higher dimensions, unfortunately. There are cases where you can do it if you work on the torus. Like if you work on a higher dimensional torus, then you can learn some things. So Edgar Shigulian has a whole program doing that from a few years ago. But for example, you can't compute the black hole entropy in higher dimensions, because there you would want to do a spatial sphere. And then there's no symmetry relating that with the time circle. So that's why I could only do the check in ADS3 CFT2.
Are you confident that there's an argument that in higher D you really do need all of these 20 unorientable images, or?
You know, I mean, the argument I think is the one I give on the first slide, that CRT has to be a gauge symmetry, so you have to include these things. I can't directly check in a particular non-perturbative theory of quantum gravity in higher than three dimensions. There may be some supersymmetric things. I don't know. Maybe Davide can do it, you know, in his head while walking to lunch. But at least for the black hole entropy, that's what happened, right? Is in ADS3, you can do cardiology and nail the black hole entropy. In higher dimensions, that doesn't work, but you can do BPSology instead of cardiology. So I didn't at all try to think about whether or not there could be some version of this, which is BPS. And if it is, then you could try to do it in higher dimensions, you know, using localization or something like that. But that's way over my pay grade. And, you know, who knows, maybe doing these things always breaks supersymmetry. It's certainly possible. So I don't.
Einstein theory is not even clear that summing over geometries is the dominant thing, right? Because brains presumably make that notion very fuzzy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. So somehow this language, so I can state clearly the rules from the point of view of low energy effective field theory, what kind of things you sum over. I'm hampered by the fact here that I don't have a non-perturbative theory of quantum gravity in the bulk. So, we can, in ADS-CFT, where I understand the boundary theory, so I can do precise computation, and then I can try to compare to low energy effective field theory. And similarly with JT and the matrix models, but.
I wonder if there are some brains that could sort of whose back reaction can make the geometry non-orientable.
So you certainly I guess part of that I understand, right? So there was this idea that on the world sheet, gauging world sheet parity gives you open strings. And if you instead do the orientifold, it gives you D-brains. I mean, open strings are also D-brains. They're D25 brains or whatever, but or D9 brains if you're doing 2B. I'm not sure what's currently the story about, trying to find these end of the world brains directly in string theory. I guess there was a paper by Jake McNamara and Matt Reese. So something that I didn't talk about here, but that we could talk about is magnetic charges for space-time inversion. So you can try to argue that by completeness, that if you can make sense of the word magnetic charge for parity, then it should probably exist. And so we have a little section about that, and they also discussed that in a paper last year. And at least some of those, they matched onto things like O6 planes. So I guess at least some of those charges they were able to match on to extended objects in string theory.
I was wondering if there's some kind of a notion of it, there could be a notion of a tiny cross cut, like in a cross cut which changes the geometry, one over the string instead of one over the string squared.
So like a thing that I would argue, for example, like I didn't have time to talk about it, but we could say, like, you know, in 3+1 dimensions, could you have a cosmic string with the property that if you go around it in a circle, time gets reversed? So at least as a sort of a black string, I can write down geometries which have that property. And to the extent that they have microstates, those should be objects in string theory. I guess to make sure that it's an object we can actually find, we have to make it BPS, I guess. And then that gets into the things that I don't know about.
not something where you're tiny. Can you have something with a small circle? And if you go to the circle, you invert time, but otherwise you don't. I don't know.
Well, that's kind of what this is, right? It's so the circle.
Okay, had better make this the thing into a little loop.
The circle had better.
Why do you want it to be small?
Just.
Well, it better not be contractible, right, Davide? Because if it's if it's contractible, then this is not going to happen. So it has to be going around something.
I want it small because I wanted to see if this can be something that appears only already the order of timbering, like of corrections.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I feel like these magnetic charges, something like that.
Anyway.
Yeah.
So. Can I ask a dumb question? Is like, how do I start seeing, like, when I'm trying to wick rotate from the Euclidean story, all of these weird things I can do in the Lorentzian signature? Like, or is that not a good question? I don't know if it's a good question.
No, I mean, I think you can, right? Like, so, I mean, I when I define these correlators, right, in the pseudo state, you know, in practice, those are constructed by analytic continuation from
Euclidean. So you're saying that I have someone...
Yeah, you have to figure out what's the right continuation to do. You know, there's a lot, I mean, as you know, like different continuations give you different objects. And so you have to think about what's the right one. Yeah, so I think that is how we do things in some sense.
So put a different way, could you say that if I look at the space of all possible analytic continuations I do from the Euclidean, like say propagators or whatever, that I end up finding these non-orientable guys or is that not a fair thing?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure. So it depends how, for example, do you include complex solutions, right? So some of these things, I don't know. Yeah, so this question of what are the things you're supposed to include in the Euclidean path and rule is always confusing in gravity, because at least in some cases you want to include complex saddles, and if you include all complex saddles, then yes, I believe what you said is true. Everything is an analytic continuation of everything else, but I don't know. Euclidean gravity is scary that way. You know, Ed made some rule for what are the things you're supposed to include, but I think his rule is wrong, so I don't know. I mean, that's this basic problem we have with Euclidean gravity, right? It's like, it's witchcraft, you know, it's an oracle that tells us things, but we don't know why or what the rules should be. Yeah, I mean, somehow in practice, the rule is that we include a saddle if it gives us an answer that we like. But that's not a particularly satisfying state of affairs.
Any other questions? If not, I think an hour and a half is a good, like, extra buffer, so it's fine. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you for the invitation.